first, I want to extend a very warm welcome indeed to our three speakers today, and welcome to all of you as well. As you can see, it's been a very busy day so far. I'll briefly introduce our three speakers. The format is that they are going to talk for no longer than 10 minutes about their career paths, experiences, and give you some advice, and then I'll open the floor for questions. So first, Phil Bloomer is currently Director of Campaigns and Policy at Oxfam, formerly Head of Advocacy, and previous to that has worked for many years in Latin America on economic justice and other issues. We then have Helen Campbell-Pickford, who is currently here actually doing a DPhil, but prior to that taught English and drama before joining VSO and going to work in Sri Lanka. She has trained teachers in Malaysia and has also worked in the Congo with children in crisis, amongst other things. That's just a snippet. And Renate Reisinger from Médecins Sans Frontières. Renate trained as a children's nurse and has since been on four missions with MSF, two to the Congo, one to Afghanistan, and one to Burundi. And in between missions, continues to work as a children's nurse and also training nurses in Albania. So without further ado, I will ask Phil, please, to take the floor.
Thank you. Well, it's great to see so many people here, and I suppose we're right here to attempt to inspire you to join our area of work and effectively devote your life to something that won't give you an enormous amount of monetary return, but may give you an enormous amount of satisfaction. So I was asked to, first of all, just briefly describe my role. I'm the Campaigns and Policy Director for Oxfam, and I was trying to think of a simile for what I do during the day. It will sound immodest, but I mean it in the best possible way. Possibly one way to describe it is as a tiny little West Wing somewhere in Oxford, in the sense that, you know, in the last 2 weeks we've issued a paper on reconstruction in Haiti for the anniversary of the earthquake. They're essentially calling for far greater efforts from the United Nations, from donors, from the Clinton, President Clinton, but also from the Haitian government, with inevitable, therefore, quite a lot of reaction back, saying, "Who the hell are you to criticise us regarding reconstruction? We're making the best that we possibly can out of this." And so there's a backwards and forwards in an attempt to shift the debate forward to make sure that people are really putting the emphasis on reconstruction, the need to clear that enormous amount of rubble that's still there and start getting people back in houses and out of tents on old golf courses, etc. At the same time, we've met with Madame Lagarde, the finance minister of France, to talk about their presidency of the G20 and the G8 this week, and therefore they've said that they want to act on the financial transaction tax, which we believe is essential for climate finance, but it's also essential for development finance over the next 20 years. So we've been working with them on that, and they've also said that they're going to prioritise the speculation in agricultural commodities, which were at least partly to blame for the price spike that threw another 200 million people into hunger in 2008. So again, asking them to hold true to what they've said and make sure that they feel that they've got support, public support, civil society support, citizens' support from around the world to really push that issue, to make sure that as the price spike happens, as it may well happen this year, that there is going to be some regulation of the hedge funds and pension funds, which are in some part, greater or smaller, contributing to the volatility that's directly affecting the poorest and vulnerable people on this planet, and defining whether young children are going to go to bed hungry tonight when we perhaps go out for a drink. I think the other thing we've been doing is there's been a series of attacks this week just in the UK, for instance, by the UK Tax Alliance, also by the Adam Smith Institute, saying, oh, aid, old paradigm, development, all that kind of thing. What we need is growth, fastest growth possible, and it will, you know, a rising tide raises all boats. The trickle-down theory of development will definitely work. We don't need to worry about redistribution. And therefore, we've been coming back trying to make sure that issue around what really will constitute development, what the vital nature of growth with equity in our own society as well as in societies and in terms of international justice, those things remain extremely important. So that's a quick smattering of the kind of stuff that I'm involved in, as well as perhaps the long-term work that I do, which is looking, we're about to launch a major new campaign in May on food justice issues, but food justice issues as they relate to also the, our resource-constrained world, as we are now crashing through the planetary boundaries, ecological boundaries, whether it's in climate or whether it's in fresh water scarcity. You are the generation, in a sense, that's going to have to face up to those issues. And organisations like Oxfam and VSO, MSF, are all involved in some ways in trying to talk through what are the major challenges. So why do I work in development? That was another thing I was asked. Well, I work in development essentially because I have a passion for international justice. I have a passion for a belief that we are all equal as human beings. We live in a world of absurd and obscene inequality, where a child dies every 3 seconds in this world from preventable diseases. Meanwhile, the number of billionaires continues to grow. And we have to be able to somehow marry, as a human race, the fact that we face, increasingly now, a shared destiny. And we have to be able to organize ourselves in terms of global governance, but also in terms of national approaches to make sure that we've got a better world for the future, which isn't as scarred as perhaps the generation before us, and perhaps my generation is about to leave it. So we have, I think, when Nelson Mandela stood on the steps of Trafalgar Square on a cold January morning in 2005, he said that essentially overcoming global poverty is the moral equivalent now of the anti-apartheid struggle and the anti-slavery struggle. And that sometimes it falls on a generation to be great. Well, effectively, you are that generation. It falls on you to make something of this world for the next time, because if we don't make the right decisions in the next 10, I would argue 10 years, possibly 20 years, certainly Nick Stern would say the next 5, but if we don't make the right decisions and choose a path that was going to lead this world onto a far better, perfectly doable path of greater equity, of greater responsibility towards our environment, then we are going to face a far more dark and glowering planet. And that's why many of us are involved in this work. How I got into it? Well, I'm a complete fraud. I'm the campaigns and policy director for Oxfam. I have a degree in agriculture. In fact, I have a degree in agricultural botany. But don't tell anybody that. So I got involved really because I was... I come from, I suppose, a family where you studied to get a job, and so vocational work, you know, vocational degree was the obvious thing to do. And so although I was very interested in international politics, I got involved through agriculture. So I spent about 4 or 5 years working as a volunteer in soil and water conservation with an organization very similar to VSOs for at least 3 of those years. And then from there, moved into the management of programs, bigger programs that I was involved in, starting with agriculture, then moving much more into human rights and economic justice, and am I all right? And then moving from there, really increasingly, I was able to, lucky enough, to job share in Colombia for 4 years with my wife. And therefore, at the same time as doing all that management stuff, I was starting to do more and more voluntary work again, but with the Justice and Peace Committees that were working on human rights in Colombia, with some of the legal organizations, civil society organizations that were working on the free trade area agreements. So as you can see, I've kind of moved into much more of the policy end of it. And then finally, having done a lot more on policy work in the 90s, I moved into much seeing the fact that actually we ain't going to shift politicians on these big, big issues until they become either electorally dangerous or electorally very rewarding. And so it's the public that are going to matter as much as the evidence that we can generate from august institutions like Oxford University. We have to be able to reach into their hearts and emotionally engage the publics, particularly in the north, but also the middle classes in China and India and Brazil. And so I'm involved in a lot of global public-facing campaigning, as we call it, organizing, trying to help organize those that work, principally through working with our partners and allies, who are, of course, the people who can speak out with real authority and credibility in those countries. I was asked to speak briefly about money. 1 minute. So I think I've said what I need to do about money. It's tough at the start. I think for a lot of people, you know, it does take quite a lot of commitment to be able to do that voluntary work for some time. But on the other hand, we don't pay penury wages. You know, there is a commitment to treating our employees as fairly as we can. In fact, Oxfam always gets very high marks in terms of Guardian's employers' ratings. That's not because we pay high wages, it's because we treat our staff with enormous care, because in the end, those are the people that really will deliver for us. And I think just finally, the key, how to get into the sector, I'd just say there are many different skills that we require in this sector. If you imagine working on major humanitarian disasters such as happened in Pakistan this year or in Haiti, the fact is we require brilliant water engineers, hands up. We also require, though, fantastic project managers who can work in extremely adverse situations, who are able to inspire people, but also really get organised and think through the business of delivering clean water to 1 million people, which is what we're doing currently in Haiti, and taking away 1 million people's poo every day, which is the other thing we do every day, because if they don't, there's a high likelihood that cholera would have spread far, far faster through the camps than it has already. Equally, we require, in our campaigning, fantastic communication skills, but also real political nous. You know, the understanding of how change happens in the world and how we can make our best efforts to really stand by the enormous trust that people put into us when they pay our wages, to make a difference in the world, to make a difference to the world tomorrow for the poorest and most vulnerable people on the planet. But all those people in Oxfam really require enormous communication skills and great people skills. You need to be able to work to basically what we sometimes describe as helicoptering up and down. So sometimes you'll be talking to the Minister of Finance or the Minister of Water, and the next minute you'll be speaking to peasant communities about their direct situation and what they need, and consulting firmly with them to really get what they require. I'm shutting up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Right.
Hi, good afternoon. I think I'll just skip through the first bit quite quickly because it was very traditional. I did a degree, I got a teacher training qualification. I taught in this country for about 8 years, teaching English and drama. All the way through that time, I was doing voluntary work on the side while also employed as a teacher. Most of it in theatres, and all of it simply because I really, really enjoyed it. But I mention it because I think that was then very useful. When I came to apply to VSO, I had already been doing little bits of part-time voluntary work for many years. And obviously, if it's not your first voluntary assignment, when you commit to going abroad for 2 whole years, you know, it does show some commitment to having done voluntary work. I was frankly amazed when VSO offered me a position as a teacher trainer in Sri Lanka, because up until then I was just a straightforward classroom teacher. So actually my first tip is, when you do voluntary work, it should be a step up from your current skill level. If you are already a teacher, you know, you might do some teacher training. You know, if you're already, well, for example, a friend of mine who was a physiotherapist and who was fitting artificial limbs, learnt to design and build artificial limbs as well as fitting them and doing the physiotherapy with the injured people and so on. That kind of thing. Training people is very often a big part of voluntary work, because essentially your object is to make yourself obsolete. You're going to be there probably for about 2 years and then you're going to leave. And when you leave, if those people have still got the skills that you've taught them, that's obviously far better than you arriving, inoculating a load of children and then leaving. You know, if you train people to do what it is that you do. So that step up in skill level is something that I would definitely look for in voluntary work. I was also amazed and not in a good way when I arrived in Trincomalee in northeast Sri Lanka, which at the time, this was 2001, there was still fighting going on between the Tamil Tigers and the government, and discovered that my house that I was supposed to be living in had partly collapsed. I'm not entirely sure why, but the roof had caved in. And I spent my first night in northeast Sri Lanka sleeping under a mosquito net, basically in the open air, and I could see tracer bullets going past at the end of the peninsula. So, you know, this is just a taste of volunteer life. It's not always that dramatic, but occasionally, you know, you get an experience like that, which does stick in the memory. My second tip is that you can do your voluntary job and other stuff too. And people very often tend to assume that, you know, your voluntary job is going to absorb 100% of your time and attention. And I think, you know, certainly for the first 6 months, it will absorb nearly all of your time and attention. But then start to look for other stuff that you can do, you know, because one of the problems that, well, not problem exactly, but one of the things about volunteers is that they tend to be obviously passionately committed people. And there's always this risk that they do nothing but work, you know, so start looking for other stuff that you can do once you've got your job set up. What I found to do, I did a distance learning MA while I was in Sri Lanka, which might actually be taking it a bit far. I also ran drama festivals and, you know, got to know what was happening in local performances and so on. So don't just do your job, find other things to do. When I left VSO, that allowed me, the reference I got from VSO allowed me to get a paid proper job as a teacher trainer in Malaysia with an NGO called CFBT, which stands for Centre for British Teachers, and they concentrate on education and particularly teacher training in developing countries. So my next tip is about your reference. The people who write your reference in which developing country it is have no very clear idea of what it means to the people back home, what you've been dealing with in that country. So to them, it's entirely obvious that you were dealing with, you know, different faiths, different cultures, possibly a language barrier, extremely limited resources and so on. You know, to them, that's obvious and they don't necessarily mention it in your reference. You want them to mention it because then when you get back to England or, you know, whatever place you come from, and that isn't mentioned in your reference, again, the people back home then have no very clear idea of what you were dealing with out there. So essentially, negotiate your reference, get them to put down what you were dealing with. It's obvious to them, but it's not obvious to your next employers. I very rapidly discovered once I got to Malaysia that the big difference between doing voluntary work with people who had asked me to go there and work with them and doing work, I was training teachers, but they were rounded up and brought and put in the room by school inspectors, is that, you know, a percentage of them didn't want to be there and weren't terribly interested. And this was kind of a baptism of fire. And, you know, what's absolutely fabulous about volunteer work is that the people you are working with passionately want to work with you and are absolutely interested and absorbed by everything you say and are kind of pre-motivated, whereas doing development work in other contexts isn't always, you can't always guarantee that they want to work with you. Sometimes you have to start off by persuading them, you know, motivating them that they want to work with you. It's possible, you know, it just takes a bit longer, can be time consuming. So my next tip, you can do a very difficult job in an absolutely fantastic location for years. You can do a really, really wonderful job in a very difficult location for years. And of course, if you're incredibly lucky, you get a wonderful job in a wonderful location. But if the location, if the place that you're working is a really, really difficult environment, the job has to be very, very motivating for you to stay there. You have to be absolutely committed to it, heart and soul. And this is what I found when I was working in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I was in the eastern side of the country on the border area between Rwanda, Burundi and Uganda. I think you were the same place, right? heartbreakingly beautiful, but really astoundingly difficult place to live. You know, just in terms of constant violence, constant stress, lack of resources, you know, including water and electricity, this kind of thing. Militia bands wandering up and down, you know, random gunfire. It was all fairly, fairly serious stuff. But people kept asking me, you know, why are you staying there? Why don't you just leave, you know, go somewhere else? And the answer was because the people that I was working with, Children in Crisis and Ebenezer Ministries were our local partners in Congo, were the most wonderful people, and they were absolutely passionately committed to international justice, social justice, peacemaking, community building. The work that I was doing there was largely teacher training, but involved a lot of working with other community leaders as well. A lot of people who were serially displaced. You know, they were shifted from village to village to village, camp to camp, quite often with, you know, very, very severe difficulties just getting from one day to the next. And there's that sense that, you know, the more difficult the situation is, the more rewarding it is when you achieve, you know, more or less anything at all. Actually, I think we achieved quite a lot. We trained, I think, 260 teachers in the time that I was there. We built four schools. So location versus job. You know, if the job's fantastic, the location doesn't have to be. If the location is fantastic, you can do a really difficult job and survive it. My last tip, I'm afraid this is going to sound rather cynical, but again, it's something that I've come to after working overseas for about 11 years, is that there has to be something in it for you. And I can't think of a way to put that that doesn't sound really cynical. But you are giving your time and your energy and, you know, everything that you have to work in, you know, very often quite difficult circumstances. It feels better if there is something that you also get out of it, you know, which might be that you get to practice a language that you're interested in, that you travel in the region, that you get to do some personal research, that you get to write about your experiences, whatever it is. Volunteers go into things with these wonderfully virtuous motives, and, you know, which is absolutely fantastic, and of course they should. But, you know, by all means, while you are benefiting other people, there should also be some benefit to you. It's not like, you know, it's a zero sum. You should also benefit from the experience. And that way you will have a better time and feel more motivated to go on to the next job. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. As Jane said, I'm a children's nurse from my professional background, and I'm Austrian, so I've done my training there. And when I first qualified, there were very few jobs around, and that was just one of the excuses I needed, really, to start looking abroad. And since then, I've been a nanny for French-speaking family in Switzerland, and I've worked in general pediatrics in a hospital in Austria for a couple of years. I've done community pediatrics, and for the last 4 years, I've been a staff nurse in children's intensive care here in Oxford at the John Radcliffe. And for the past 9 years, I've been taking out time out of my contracts, always negotiated that with employers, to take time and join charities. And I've mostly worked with Médecins Sans Frontières, but I've also done work with smaller organizations, which may not mean much to you because they were Austrian, but I worked in Albania, for example. So with Médecins Sans Frontières, you may or may not have a bit of an idea of what we do. We are a medical relief organization, so we will go into places where the local health system has either collapsed or is overwhelmed with an epidemic, with a natural disaster, or, for example, diseases like HIV and tuberculosis, where the health system just doesn't have the money or the manpower to deal with it. And I've just brought just a couple of pictures just to give you snapshots, just little images of what I've been doing with Médecins Sans Frontières. In Afghanistan, for example, I was there in 2002, and we supported, well, it was one of the projects, we supported a rural hospital, and I was there to supervise and train the nurses in that hospital, and that involved, for example, running and overseeing the pharmacy, and the other pictures, I was just making sure the hospital was clean, and teaching and training the cleaning ladies as much as the nurses, really. I worked in Burundi for about 10 months in 2005, and there I went to do an assessment of the health situation of a population in the eastern part of the country, which we thought was neglected and had very difficult access to healthcare. So I basically went around and asked lots and lots of questions and talked to lots of people, and then basically put all this information together and made recommendations of what we should do about that. Again, that's not necessarily something I was trained to do in my nurse training, but all the skills I've ever learned before definitely came in very useful in doing that. I was also then involved in a meningitis vaccination campaign, which is something we do fairly often, trying to make sure to sort of prevent an outbreak of diseases. And here I forgot just how many thousands of people we vaccinated within a few weeks. Working with MSF will always involve lots of data gathering and lots of report writing. So whatever professional you are, you will end up doing lots and lots of paperwork. You need to report back to your donors. You need to make sure it's all transparent, what's happened to all the money. And you need to evaluate your work all the time, continuously. So it does always involve a lot of paperwork, basically. And it does involve lots of bumpy roads and lots of getting very dirty on the way to work, like this is Eastern Congo, as you may. I've just put that one in because that may be something that people may not think of it in the first place, but I remember this as something being very, very, very tiring, spending hours and hours and hours on end in the car on these roads, getting stuck time and again, getting out, pushing it out again, getting stuck again, pushing it out again, and then still trying to treat your patients once you get to your clinics, and then all the way back you face this again. So it does take a certain stamina, and it does take a certain, let's put health, to do this, yeah. I'm quite glad of what you said about what got you into working with charities and what made you stay in there, because that saves me from sort of repeating it all again. And I guess you're probably much more interested in how you get into these organizations and what you need to do and what will they ask you to have. In MSF, we are a medical organization, so we will need the whole variety of medical professionals, but we also need people who can run the finance part and the logistical part of the operations. And if you still think you don't fit any of these criteria, I think Phil is a very good example. If you're still interested, then still have a look and persevere and see whether you can fit in, because people from very different backgrounds have found they can be very useful, doing some very useful work within MSF. The competition for jobs is just as fierce as it is for any other job that you apply for here. Well, that's what I found anyway. It's not any easier. The standards are just as high. You definitely need to have several years of working experience in your profession, whatever you're doing, and a really good, sound knowledge. Because once you're out in the field, you will be very likely not necessarily the most senior person in the field, but if you're a surgeon or an anaesthetist, then you're probably the only person who can do surgery, and there will be no backup. You will be the surgeon in AMSF project. And even as a nurse, you'll very likely end up being the most senior person of your team as far as nurses are concerned. So you do need to know what you're doing, because even though there's internet available now in many places, but you can't always Google everything when you've got a patient in front of you in some outpatient clinic somewhere. And you will very likely be involved in teaching and training and supervising your local colleagues. That is, by definition, going to be part of your work if you join MSF. I'd always advise anybody to learn languages. Obviously, there are many countries where you get by with English perfectly fine, but there are loads of other countries where English is not spoken or where it's not the main language. And any other language you speak beyond English will really open up so many more opportunities, and you'll just get so many more experiences and chances, really, in life. So languages, definitely make an effort and do something beyond English. And the other advice, certainly if you want to join an organization like MSF, who is really working out in the outback where there's nobody else, do go traveling. Get your backpacks out and literally get off the beaten track, because that will give you a sense what it's like to live in climates that are not as nice and temperate and same temperature all year round, like it's in the UK, really. And whether you'll be able to function when it's 40 degrees, or very humid, for example, or very cold, like minus 20 in Afghanistan and in a mud house with no heating. Yeah. And it will give you an idea whether you can cope with very different food, with very different hygienic conditions, with very different and very basic living standards. And you'll also find out whether you can actually work in cultures that are not your own and where people may have quite different outlooks on work, attitudes to punctuality, and all the rest of it. So you may then find that it's actually not for you. And traveling is a really good way of finding it out, an easy way. It's 10 minutes. And persevere if it doesn't happen the first time around, because you will not regret it. It's definitely worth it.